So what is the soul? We asked a few people on the streets outside our studio.
The soul is our interdimensional connection to each other and everything else living.
I think that the soul is really the core being of who someone is. Maybe, you know, from sort of a Judeo-Christian tradition, it would be like the mind, the will, the emotions, you know, who you are, what you think, what you want, what you do.
I don't think I believe in a soul. What people think of as the soul is probably just maybe your interior self. The soul's part of your body. It's all the same thing.
The question of what the soul is one that just cannot be answered by somebody like me. It would take a whole lifetime of contemplation just to get a glimpse at that answer.
What is the soul? I think the soul is love and, yeah, love.
I guess as a Unitarian, I would say that there's this undercurrent of life essence, whatever that means, that goes from person to person and animals and everything in between, and that all connecting.
The soul is the real part of us. We're this spiritual being that's really having a physical experience as opposed to physical beings having a spiritual experience. And so the soul is the immaterial, the unseen part of us, where our passions and our heart and our desires come together to really shape and define who we are. It's the true essence of the human being.
A special thanks to Brittany DeAnda for producing that Vox Pop. Nancy Murphy is a professor of Christian philosophy at Fuller Theological Seminary. She's also immersed in the scientific literature on neuroscience and biology. Made Steve Paulson wonder just what a modern theologian, at least Nancy Murphy, thinks about all this soul talk.
For centuries, the soul has been one of the core ideas of certain religious traditions, and it would seem to be very remote from the empirical world of science. Do you think science has anything useful to say about the soul?
Yes, that there isn't one.
End of discussion.
Well, intended to be a provocative beginning of discussion because the issues are much more subtle than that. The thesis that I put forward is that the idea of a soul comes not from Hebrew or Christian revelation, but actually has origins in a number of other religions, but primarily in Greek philosophy. Plato, one of the primary sources, believed that the soul is not only immortal, but that it's eternal. That is, it preexists the body.
Okay, well, let's bring this story a little closer to our own time and bring in science then, because it would seem that Darwin in particular posed some challenges. I mean, of course, the revolutionary idea of Darwin is that there is this gradual continuum from animals to humans and that you can't just draw a sharp dividing line and say, okay, at this moment, humanity started.
That's right.
Which raises some pretty profound questions about the soul.
That's right. And it's gotten more and more complicated as the years have gone by because we've found that we are not simply descendants of apes, but we're descendants of a long branching history of hominids. And to ask where in that those thousands, millions of years of continuous development, you would decide, okay, the humans begin here. And so if God's going to start inserting souls, God has to start with this particular branch of the tree at this particular point in history.
You are a Christian yourself. In fact, you are an ordained minister. What do you make of this history of souls?
Well, the interesting thing is long before people got worried about the consequences of either neuroscience or evolutionary biology, biblical scholars had already raised the question of whether body-soul dualism actually shows up in the scriptures or not. And there's an almost complete consensus that the Hebrew scriptures, what we Christians call the Old Testament, does not teach body-soul dualism. The word that has been translated most often as soul in the older versions, such as the King James Version, the Hebrew word in most cases is nephesh. And that's a word that can take on multiple meanings, all the way from being used to designate the throat, By association, it designates the breath that flows through the throat. And then when people die, they expire, they breathe their last. And so nefesh is associated with being a living being.
So it sounds like you want to get away from this dualism.
Absolutely.
That especially came down from Descartes. That just doesn't make sense.
And also what came down from Plato. I think that was an intrusion into Christian theology. The whole of Western Christianity would have been better off had that not happened. And the reason I say that is, to put it rather bluntly, if Christians had not thought all of these centuries that there was such a thing as souls to save, they would have had to find something different to do. And maybe what they would have found themselves doing is, for instance, taking some of Jesus' teachings about living in this world more seriously.
This is quite a radical critique here, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Of traditional Christianity.
Yes, it is.
You're really suggesting that the history of not only of Christianity, but the history of the West could have been very different without this dualistic split between body and soul.
Absolutely. And we're still seeing extremely negative effects of body-soul dualism in contemporary politics. If you believe that the end is going to be a matter of gathering souls off to heaven, as opposed to the kingdom of God being fully established on earth, you're going to have much less concern with politics, with feeding the poor, with peace, with the environment.
So what about the soul itself, that word? Does that word have resonance for you? I mean, more than as a historian, but as a believer yourself? I mean, is this a concept that we should hang on to?
No, it's not.
But you must think that there's more to us than just the brain, I'm presuming.
Well, I call myself a non-reductive physicalist. And the physicalist signals that in terms of what stuff we're made of no different stuff than anything else in the physical world. But the non-reductive part signals that we're not just rocks, we're not just animals, we're not even just smart animals. We are fancy deluxe animals. We've got the capacity for morality. We've got the capacity for much more subtle emotional responses. We've got the capacity for higher level reasoning, including symbolic reasoning. And most important, we've got the capacity to understand what the concept God means, and we've got the capacity to relate to God.
So all of that, with perhaps the exception of the last thing you were talking about, our capacity to relate to God, is very consistent with modern science,
That's right.
With neuroscience. There is this very concerted effort among scientists to try to figure out which parts of the brain seem to govern religious experience. Does that have any bearing on what we're talking about?
Well, if you're a physicalist, then it goes without saying that any experience that a human being has is going along with something going on in the brain. And if you thought that religious experience was just one sharply restricted type of experience, for instance, mystical awareness, then it would make sense to think that there might be some particular brain region or regions that are responsible for that and solely responsible for that. But I have a much broader concept of religious experience. I'm not a mystic, and so I'm much more interested in what you might call more ordinary types of religious experiences. And so I think, for instance, that when I'm in church on Sunday and we sing a hymn about God's concern for the poor, and I get choked up over that and my eyes tear up, I think that's a good old down-home instance of a religious experience. And there's no specifically localizable brain region that's doing that. I mean, it's happening in my eyes and it's happening in my chest and my throat when I feel those emotions. It's much more a whole body experience.
So one last question. Life after death. You've banished the soul from our vocabulary. How should we talk about the being that presumably exists in Christian thinking after the physical body dies? What is that that is still existing?
There are two ways to go. Either you can say simply that we are dead until the general resurrection, when we'll be raised up together. And that's not, by the way, a resuscitated corpse, but rather it's a body composed of some sort of transformed or recreated stuff. What that doesn't answer is, what about between when I die and the end of the world, whenever that's going to be. So one way to go is to say that I'm just plain dead, like an animal would be. But another way to go is to say that we can't put resurrection on an earthly timeline, because after all, time is a part of the creation of the physical world. And if we are resurrected to be with God, then we are somehow transcending the physical world, and it's not clear that earthly timelines apply. So one way of putting it, and I always stress that this is putting it in almost nonsense language, maybe each of us is resurrected elsewhere, else when, at the moment of our deaths, and so there isn't any time lag between my death and my resurrection.
Nancy Murphy, talking with Steve Paulson. Murphy teaches Christian philosophy at Fuller Theological Seminary.
Oh, who's gonna save my soul?
So does the soul still matter? We've talked with scientists, philosophers, and theologians, but we wanted to give the last word to a novelist, specifically to Marilynne Robinson, the celebrated author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Gilead and the Orange Prize-winning book Home. Robinson's novels are famous for their serious treatment of religious ideas, and she's just written a book of essays that spells out her thoughts about what modern science says about the mind. It's called Absence of Mind. And Strange Chimps talked with Marilynne Robinson about the soul in the age of modern science.
At an earlier period in American history, it was much more commonplace for people to concern themselves with grappling about the nature of the soul or thoughts about the welfare of their soul. And today, well, we have other words and other languages that we apply to our interior lives. Do you think we've lost something? Does the soul still matter?
I myself incline very much toward the idea that the word soul does indeed describe something very essential. It describes the sort of primary experience of oneself that any human being has in the course of life. You know, the love that you have for the fact of being, the capacity for disappointment in oneself that one has.
What is the soul, do you think? I mean, is it the same thing as the mind?
I have no idea. I've read a fair amount of, you know, the sorts of things that undertake to describe the mind or the brain or consciousness, whatever. And no one knows what any of that is or what is the best way to describe it. So my only basis for opinion is my own experience.
Is this awareness of your soul? Is that something you've had all your life from as far back as you can remember, or is it a sort of learned concept?
Certainly, in some sense, I have had that experience back into my deepest memory. Perhaps the most striking early memories that I have were exactly the feeling of, you know, the more than self. I mean, a lot of the sharpest memories I have of my childhood were being on a porch at night and hearing the wind blow in the forests around my grandfather's house and just feeling this overwhelming sense of the density of, you know, existence in some way. I mean, that ponderous language to impose on a childhood memory, but nevertheless, just moments like that where nothing happened.
More recently, you've written a book of essays about the mind, which in some ways would seem to be kind of a departure from the novels that you've written that deal a great deal with religious subjects. And yet, do you see a connection between the religious subjects you've explored in your fiction and the ideas that you grapple with in Absence of Mind?
Well, you know, the absolute center of my religious loyalty feeling, whatever you want to call it, is the sacredness of human beings. And I am very disturbed by a kind of minimization of the elegance and richness of human existence that seems to be so, so pervasive.
How do you see that playing out? Do you mean because our science tends to be very materialistic, teach us that, you know, all we are is meat?
Some science, and I would put that in quotation marks, is very materialistic, and it tends to assume the kind of materialism that would have been assumed in the 18th century. If you read, you know, modern physics, modern cosmologies, the whole idea of a simple, comprehensible physical world simply evaporates. The physical world reads like Byzantine theology or something. You know, if you read about it from the point of view of the subatomic world and so on, you know, or speculations about the structure of the universe or the nature of it.
Well, it sounds as though you have found a way to bring a scientific perspective of the world and your religious faith together.
It seems to me that the longer I think about theology, the more it opens to me, and the more I read, to the extent that I can, in scientific publications and so on, the more that opens to me. I feel that the genius of both of them is to be open.
Can you think of moments when the two have come together? Have you read something scientific and felt that you were reading theology?
Well, you know, I love to read about the new cosmologies, and I know that they are, you know, string theory and M theory and all these things. I know they're speculative. I know that they are at least untestable for the moment, perhaps forever. I love reading about multiverses and all the rest of it, simply because all of these things, by virtue of being respectable hypotheses, open a sense of the magnificent complexity of reality. It's like reading good theology. I get my Scientific American and I go straight to the new cosmologies.
What do you love especially? I mean, I guess what I wish is that I could hear the great Marilynne Robinson, one of our most brilliant writers, tell me what's beautiful about string theory.
Well, you know, the idea that there are any number of potential dimensions. I mean, I think I've seen 7. I think I've seen 11. You know, the speculations on how many unexpressed dimensions of reality exist in, you know, whatever that means. And the idea of this sort of unimaginable other potential that somehow is implicit in given reality is just very beautiful to my mind. And I, you know, whether it's true or not, I enjoy the thought.
So going back to the concept of the soul, you know, we began talking about some of your own intuitions about what it is, this deeply internal felt experience of the larger, deeper self. Can you imagine a science that might get at some of that?
I suspect that a science that described the soul would be called poetry. I mean, one of the things that we do as human beings is ornament existence lavishly with music and poetry and everything, you know. And what we're doing really is inscribing our humanity on the planet where we happen to find ourselves, this odd little planet. And I think that the idea that there's an opposition between the expression of these intuitions in the form that they've classically taken and science, the fact that these worlds don't talk to each other, trivializes art and it trivializes science, I think.
Marilynne Robinson talked with Anne Strangechamps. Robinson's novels include Gilead and Home. Her collection of essays is called Absence of Mind. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Does the Soul Still Matter? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, 5 Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Original music for the series was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on this series and to find additional material about the topics we've explored, please go to our website at ttbook.org/scienceandmeaning. And special thanks to 2 of our sponsors for Science and the Search for Meaning, the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, and Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science.
PRI, Public Radio International.